Hello, I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence at Civiline, and welcome to another edition of Civiline Insights. Please do remember to like and subscribe wherever you're getting this podcast. Well, we're recording this on Friday, the 21st of July, and we have a really busy episode in store. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host and our lead for intelligence delivery, Leo Collins. Welcome.
Afternoon, Gareth.
Well, we've got a lot to get through, Leo. We've got Baghdad, Ukraine, as ever, the grain deal. We got Peru, protests in Peru, debt reduction in Nigeria, China attack in cyber attack in China, and we have, of course, the shooting in New Zealand. Mm. Not sure we'll get through everything, but let's start off, as ever, with the subject of Ukraine. 17th of July, mm-hmm. Putin withdrew from the Black Sea grain deal, mm-hmm. originally brokered by Turkey, as a result of, we think, an attack on Kerch Bridge. This has massive impacts, but just take us back to the beginning. What's happened? What happened on 17th, and what we've seen since?
So I think in order to understand why Putin withdrew from the grain deal on the 17th, you have to go back to the end of last year, when Russia was, to an extent, embarrassed by Turkey and the UN and the international community calling its bluff on its promise to withdraw from the deal. I think in October or November 2022, the deal still went ahead, essentially. Ships still left Ukraine and Putin was left to look embarrassed. So with the Kerch Strait bridge being attacked and the deal coming up for renewal on the 17th, this was an opportunity for Putin to say, no, I mean business. And it's a very messy affair because food security and global food prices are going to be hugely impacted by this. And Russia also claims that it is intent on getting its own grain out the door, as well as ammonia and fertilizers. And so it's going to use this as an opportunity to get its foot in the door in that respect.
I mean, despite that, though, we've already seen grain prices shoot up at a time where, you know, the globe is facing record temperatures. Mm-hmm. And a host of other issues. I mean, Putin always threatened to pull out of the deal whenever it came up as a bargaining chip, but seemingly Kerch Bridge has once again struck a nerve. Mm-hmm. Do we see any way back for Putin getting back into this deal, or do we think that's it dead in the water?
I think he wants to, I mean, well, Turkey currently is saying that it's doing its best to get Putin back in the deal, as it were. But it's, I think Putin wants to see what kind of effect this will have on NATO and the European community as a whole, because we know that Ukraine looking for alternate routes for its grain out of the country causes a headache for countries that export grain themselves. Mm. And when you've got cheap Ukrainian grain coming in, the prices of countries like Hungary or various other Eastern European nations, the price of their grain is immediately pressured, goes down. Mm. And so, I mean, it's a, I guess, what do you call it, a grain drain? Does that work? Or maybe grain pain? You know, it's not ideal for Europe as a whole. And I think Putin will wait to see what kind of effect this has before making a decision on whether or not to restart the initiative.
Very disruptive. And he did say there that Ukraine is going to look for alternative shipping routes. Mm-hmm. But of course, despite the availability of a shipping route that isn't going to get smashed by Russian missiles, insurance will be almost impossible.
Mike. Yeah, exactly. You know, there are suggestions that Romania and Bulgaria will allow ships to use their coastal waters as an alternative corridor. But let's face it, I mean, even if the risk of Article 5 being initiated by a Russian attack against a vessel in those waters is enough to deter Moscow, no one's really going to take the chance to insure a vessel that may or may not be struck by a Russian missile.
Yeah, and as you say, it's, I mean, the folks that are getting impacted by this the most are actually those in sub-Saharan Africa, mm. the global south, mm. many of which remain, I guess, unaligned on the question of support for Ukraine and Russia.
Absolutely. This is a fascinating element of second-order effects, if you want, because many sub-Saharan African countries haven't outwardly come out to say that Putin and or Russia are in the wrong as a result of the activity in Ukraine. But if grain isn't reaching these countries, that puts a lot of pressure on those governments to feed their populations. And as such, maybe the withdrawal from the grain initiative will force their hand, as it were, in terms of picking a side. Sure, Putin and Russia say that they will step in and provide grain and fertilizer to these countries, but whether or not they're able to do that, who knows?
Absolutely fascinating. I know, you know, Alexander Lord from our Eurasia desk leading on the Ukraine coverage as usual. And I mean, just before we leave Ukraine as well, we've recently had US intelligence coming out saying that Putin's going to, you know, do it on Prigozhin. Maybe he'll find himself accidentally falling out of an 8th floor window. We haven't seen Prigozhin for some time. We've seen lots of reporting of you know, this Wagner summer camp in Belarus. So that's, again, something that we'll keep a close eye on. But I think we'll leave that for the next podcast. Hopefully, we'll have a bit more clarity then. But now we're going to look at Iraq. Now, we pushed out an alert yesterday as we're recording this on the storming of the Swedish embassy in Baghdad that was fortunately empty at the time. But I know you wanted to talk about that and the root causes of that.
Yeah, whenever an embassy gets stormed, especially in the context of the Middle East, it's an incredibly evocative image. One thinks back to 1979 in Tehran with the US embassy. However, I think in terms of the immediate threat to life and physical harm befalling embassy residents or staff members, we're not talking that ballpark. The embassy was empty, as you say. Yeah, there was material damage, but we aren't at that kind of critical level yet. True, the Swedish ambassador has been recalled, or rather expelled by the Iraqi government. But I think what's interesting about this situation is that there are quite important elections coming up for regional players. So in December, there are going to be local elections in Iraq, and there are going to be elections in Turkey as well, next February, I think, February 2024. And so there's every chance that regional powers or governments in these regional powers are taking advantage of public ire and discontent for their own personal gain.
Sure, because this is on the back of Quran burning threat, right? Mm-hmm. So the Swedish police allowed this march to happen, which threats of Quran burning. Yep.
So yesterday, we sent out an alert saying that there was a chance that a Quran burning or an event in which a Quran was going to be in some way desecrated would take place. It did take place. Mm-hmm. There wasn't evidence of it actually being burned or a Quran actually being burned, but there are reports that it was beaten publicly. And so the storming very much would be related to that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it's important to say that our Middle East and Africa desk did put out an alert a little while back, as you say, warning of this, because we've got quite good coverage here of the protests. So bravo to them. And I'm not sure whether our alert was the catalyst for the embassy being empty or whether they got some other information, but certainly quite timely. But I mean, you know, we got contacts on the ground in Baghdad in that circuit, very febrile atmosphere there at the moment. And there's a realistic possibility of this not being just a flash in the pan, right?
Yeah. I think going back to one of our firm favorites, Turkey, this is a power that will actually have the clout to perhaps either raise or lower tensions, because let's not forget Turkey and Sweden have an awkward little dance going on in terms of, you know, Sweden's accession to NATO. Mm. And Turkey says a lot in terms of wanting to facilitate, going back to the previous topic, the grain deal, and to be seen as a mediator. But now it has a chance to be a mediator in another sense. Yes, okay, you know, the burning or beating of a Quran is incredibly evocative for a lot of people, but this is where Turkey can actually maybe say, no, you know, we don't want to actually fall out with Sweden. We're happy to maintain the current course of accepting its NATO accession. I think it would be unlikely to see NATO take a U-turn, to see Turkey taking a U-turn in terms of blocking Sweden's accession again.
Yeah, and I mean, we had a conversation before this, and we won't go down a rabbit hole, but, you know, if they did decide to take action against Sweden, would that maybe open the grain initiative, broker a grain initiative deal? Lots to talk about, and, you know, I don't think either of us are Middle East or Russia experts, so we'll leave that to our desks and maybe invite them on the next pod. But just, you know, we did a great visual on the alert yesterday, and it does look like Baghdad bore the brunt of the protests, with, you know, the southeast of Iraq, also, you know, quite a considerable amount of protests too, but less so in the north and the west. So
I think what's important to remember is that the Sadrist movement is very much capitalizing on this issue for the purpose of elections. And yeah, you consider the ethno-political makeup of Iraq. There's going to be a lot of activity in the south, down by Basra, you know, Shia-dominated areas of the country. So yeah, watch that space in the coming weeks, months.
Well, I'm sure the Mir desk will keep a close eye on it and possibly publish a subsequent report in the coming days and weeks to kind of wrap this up. However, in terms of wrapping it up, we had a load to get through, but we've not got much time. I do want to touch on the shooting in New Zealand, mainly because it came at a time where many of our clients and our partners and friends are tapping us up for comment on the Women's World Cup. And we did issue, I think, to a couple of clients some advice that it was relatively low risk. But then we had this shooting on the 20th, I believe it was. What exactly happened there? Because it wasn't that well covered, I think, in the media.
No, and the timing couldn't have been more impactful, really. We've got this huge sporting tournament, the FIFA Women's World Cup, happening in a country where there has, in the past few years, been a horrific shooting incident in terms of the Christchurch massacre in 2019. So this has the ingredients for a very, it's a very tragic story, but actually without trying to dilute the severity of what happened, it is a flash in the pan in a sense, because the assailant was a young 24-year-old individual with a history of domestic abuse, not happy at work, and yeah, he lost it when he went to work at a construction site in Auckland. But it's nothing related to the World Cup. This is not a terror incident. It's just a case of a sole perpetrator causing havoc on a particular day at a given time.
He ended up killing, I think it was two people, injured 10 others, and he himself was...
he was killed by the police.
Was killed as well. So not terrorism, not linked to the World Cup, but there are probably a host of other implications for an incident like this.
100%, because in the wake of the Christchurch shootings, the New Zealand government was very quick to increase the restrictions on firearms. So this will be, even though it's an isolated incident, this will anger a lot of people in terms of, well, what happened to those restrictions? And when you have elections coming up in October, I think, for New Zealand, as cynical as it might seem, you know, the opposition is going to capitalize on this incident and ask the current government very serious questions in terms of what it's doing about firearm restrictions, especially in the wake of the awful Christchurch massacre.
Yeah, indeed. And as you say, you know, very suspiciously close to the site of the World Cup, looking at the map now that our Asia Pacific desk published in the alert. But in no way connected, and just a really tragic incident, but politically possibly quite impactful.
Watch this space.
So I think, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. As ever, if any of you watching or listening would like to ask us any questions on anything we've discussed today, or indeed catch up on some of the issues we didn't manage to get to, do reach out to us, and our email address will be in the show notes. But for now, Leo, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Gareth.
Well, on the 18th of June this year, Mali held a constitutional referendum, which sought to transfer military power into civilian rule. However, those who think that this signifies a distancing of civilian oversight from the current military junta are likely very much mistaken. To discuss this, I have the honour of being joined by our associate on the Middle East and Africa desk, Megan Sutcliffe. Megan, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Megan, we had a short chat about this before filming the interview, and I was frankly aghast at what's actually going on. So, first of all, what did the constitution set out, the constitutional reform set out to achieve as per the referendum?
In essence, the constitution was proposed by the military junta after they faced severe sanctions from regional groups, including ECOWAS, after they had said that they wanted to stay in power for an additional 5 years. This was unacceptable to regional groups, So they proposed this constitutional reform that would transition Mali to civilian rule. Upon reading the draft constitution, it became very evident that rather what this document aimed to do was to institutionalize the military's power in Mali's legislature, but also to massively expand the powers of the presidency. It is extremely likely that the current interim president, Colonel Assimi Goïta, will run for the presidency in the upcoming 2024 elections. And to this end, the referendum passed with an almost incredible 97% approval rate from the Malian population.
Okay, right. A lot to unpick, so forgive me. So the constitutional reform set out to give the civilian, a civilian president, far, far more powers. However, it's highly likely that the current military leader, a colonel, will at least be front runner in competing for the office of the civilian president, thereby ensuring that the current military ruler will likely have even more powers, certainly if he gets voted in as president. Is that the case?
Exactly. And there are specific clauses in the constitution that has subsequently been adopted that says that military leaders would be considered as civilians and that anybody who participated in a previous coup is absolutely fine to participate in the presidential elections as they occur.
And are they, forgive my smirk, it's a very serious subject, but this is just the Malian military junta putting one over, right, on ECOWAS. Are there going to be any competitors for the presidency above and beyond the current colonel that's in charge?
Well, there are currently several opposition coalitions in Mali, and despite the restrictions put in by the military government, Mali does experience, to a certain extent, a relatively vibrant civil society. So it is likely that there are going to be competitors and legitimate campaigns for the presidency. But considering the military's actions thus far, particularly with this referendum and the severe allegations of fraud, that even if those were particularly emotive campaigns or they managed to mobilise significant support bases, it's relatively unlikely that they would win.
Okay, so you're saying the high percentage apportioned to this victory for the reforms, 95% plus. Do you think there's evidence of fraud? Do you think that was fraudulent?
Well, most international observers and some domestic observers have said that they believe there were incidents of voter fraud in this particular referendum.
But they were observing, right?
They were, yes. However, the issue comes in the areas that they were not observing. So outside of the territory that contains the capital, Bamako, in the south, there is very little government control, and international observers were not able to go to those cities, such as Timbuktu, but also Munaka, in order to observe the voting process, given threats from multiple jihadist and insurgent groups therein. But of additional concern was that every person who at some point had served in the military was invited to vote 2 weeks early before the referendum in military bases that were inaccessible to international observers. So there was a high potential for fraud, and the fact that 97% of individuals in Mali allegedly supported this constitutional reform, despite the marches and multiple opposition parties to it preceding the vote, makes that outcome relatively unlikely to have been legitimate.
And what is the claim? What was the claimed turnout?
The claimed turnout, I believe, was below 30%.
Okay, so they did manage to adopt the turnout numbers.
Not particularly.
So 97% of the below 30% of people that turned out. Okay. And wow. Okay, right. So again, a lot to unpack. But you also said in these new reforms, there was actually more power for the military, or the military are ingrained in the state's architecture. Can you unpack that a bit?
Absolutely. So the military takes on a greater role in influencing the legislature, but also the independence of the judiciary has been significantly reduced, which is very unfortunate, particularly for clients who are looking to operate in Mali, particularly in their mining sector, in terms of uncompensated expropriation and changing government contracts over periods of time.
Okay, right. So there's some clear implications there, and I want to at some point bring Russia into it. But just to round up, the referendum sought to strengthen civilian rule, but what we actually have is a referendum that was likely fraudulently achieved, passed, that ingrains the military into the state a lot more than it currently is, reduces the power of the judiciary, and almost guarantees that the current military ruler will become the civilian president with far more powers than he has at the moment. Is that fair?
Exactly. Another aspect that is incredibly important on the security side of things is that this constitution characterizes Mali as a completely unitary state. It rules out any chance of decentralization. Now, on the face of it, that seems fine. However, it fundamentally undermines significant clauses in the 2015 Algiers Accord. This was the agreement that ended the secessionist conflict in the north of Mali between the central government and various Tuareg ethnic militias who were looking to form their own independent state. The fact that this referendum has undermined that agreement and that the coordination of movements for Azawad, their claimed territory, has said they no longer see it as binding, increases security risks and the risk of mobilization, particularly in northern Mali.
Okay, a lot of potential implications here. before we go to the implications, which I know our listeners and viewers will want to know, in recent years, we've seen the West withdraw from Mali, and we've seen the proliferation of Wagner into the country, particularly Timbuktu. I remember that the French came out almost as quick as Wagner came in. Given Wagner's form for allegedly, messing about in other people's elections and referenda, do you see any evidence that Russia had a part to play in any of this at all?
Absolutely. So the Russian presence in Malian media, as well as media throughout the Sahel region, is very well known. It's very well documented. The Internet Research Group, which was also founded by Wagner leader Yevgeny Prigozhin, has been very active in influencing various media sources in Mali and really helping to foment and mobilize anti-West and anti-French sentiment, particularly in Mali's urban areas and in the capital.
Okay. And of course, Wagner will have interests in maintaining the current leadership, right? Because under the current leadership, they've been able to conduct extraction operations and earn money.
Absolutely. So the Wagner Group and the Malian government have a symbiotic relationship. The Malian government, particularly when it was facing international sanctions and as it has had aid contributions cut, has been looking for ways to fund its own security as it faces multiple security threats. Whereas the Wagner Group is actively searching for resources such as gold, phosphates and timber, which Mali has in droves. As such, they have struck up an agreement. Allegedly, the first deployment was in December of 2021, whereby Wagner forces support and act independently of the Malian armed forces in attempting to address security crises in the north, while the Malian state provides concessions to its multiple natural resources and allows the Wagner Group to operate as it wishes.
And obviously, the Wagner Group has adopted a very similar model elsewhere in sub-Saharan Africa, as your desk, I know, has reported on repeatedly. However, let's now go to the implications. So the first one is, you say, a resumption of the conflict with the Tuaregs in the north. Very briefly, how likely is that? What are the indicators and warnings? When are we likely to see that?
So, arguably, the biggest indicator that there is going to be a resurgence in conflict is if we draw in another actor to this very complex conflict, is the UN. So the UN maintained a troop presence of approximately 15,000 personnel in Mali in an integrated stabilization mission from 2012 until very recently, when the Malian state asked that they depart as soon as possible. On the 30th of June, their mandate was revoked, and all UN troops will be withdrawn from Mali by the 31st of December, which is an impressive logistical challenge, but also has dire consequences for security, particularly in the north. With a lack of UN soldiers and with a lack of peacekeeping forces in particularly unstable areas, we're seeing an increase in the likelihood that we're going to see a Tuareg remobilization.
But surely Wagner can take care of that, right? There, that's what they claim.
I believe that's what the Malian state is hoping will happen, particularly in the areas of Timbuktu and Taoudeni. The potential remobilization of Tuareg fighters is a large concern, given their control over very lucrative industries, including some routes associated with drug trafficking and human trafficking that have grown with the breakdown of law and order, given a lack of state control. However, while I'm sure we can assume that an increase in personnel in supporting the Malian forces will have some impact in putting down rebellions, both from Tuareg fighters and from the several jihadist groups which are active in Mali, whether or not this will be an effective response remains to be established.
Because we've seen them of late, right, conduct rather blunt responses to perceived security threats, massacring civilians, etc., claiming they're Al-Qaeda. Not to dwell on that, in the cities, you say that we've already seen marches against these reforms. And you say, you know, the current military leader isn't going to be alone, whilst, you know, their control of the media and fraud and all the rest of it might mean he prevails. It will be contested. So there are other actors that will contest this. You've already seen unrest in Bamako leading up to the referendum. What's the timeline of civil unrest, and what will be the scale of it in population centres and further afield?
So what we're likely to see is that civil unrest and protests will likely centre around dates associated with the upcoming election, particularly campaign events and announcements, should they come from various military figures. However, there is also a significant likelihood that should jihadist groups continue to expand southwards and approach Bamako and conduct increasingly complex attacks on civilian infrastructure, but also key military infrastructure, including regional airports, then there is a likelihood that we'll see an uptick in protests surrounding those incidents.
Right, and by jihadists, we're talking about IS,
yes.
Islamic State in the Sahel, and other actors as well?
Absolutely. So Mali is unfortunate in that it suffers from a dual jihadist insurgency. It faces threats from the JNIM, the Group for the Support of Muslims and Islam, which is an Al-Qaeda-aligned umbrella organisation, but also faces an insurgency for Islamic State in the Greater Sahel, the regional Islamic State affiliate. These groups are not aligned with one another. They frequently clash in bordering territories, which increases bystander risk to individuals therein, but they are also known for their particularly harsh implementation of their interpretation of Islamic law and their penchant for targeting both civilians and humanitarian workers, particularly in the medical field.
And, you know, I know there were French and British troops involved in counterterrorism operations, and I believe some still are. Do we think, you know, following the UN withdrawal in December, that the Malian government and their supporting Wagner fighters will be able to not only mitigate a Tuareg conflict, but also, you know, battle Islamic State in Jenin?
I think that while the Malian government is making significant efforts to address these insurgencies, including allegedly signing a vague truce with the Islamic State in the Greater Sahel on the 7th of July, the fact that these insurgencies have been going on since 2012, the fact that civilians feel increasing and persistent insecurity and have therefore aligned themselves with multiple decentralized ethnic militias, this conflict has reached the point that it is intractable. And any effort to try and resolve it is going to have to be whole scale. Whether or not that's going to come from the Wagner Group and their civilian targeting tactics, or from the government as it remains under military control, that's very hard to evaluate. And unfortunately, I think is rather unlikely over the coming months and potentially years.
And we're really running up against time, Megan, but you did cite earlier some of the difficulties for folks doing business with entities within Mali. You know, certainly should the current military leader become president, for example, and just generally the operating environment is quite difficult. Can you very briefly unpack what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So there are several significant security risks and governance risks to firms operating in Mali. Of primary concern are the physical security risks, so multiple insurgent groups frequently ambush and attack convoys, the threats to staff in terms of kidnapping, but also being bystanders to attacks. There are also well-known campaigns of sexual violence in multiple parts of Mali, which show a distinctly gendered aspect to this conflict. There is also the significant threat of the government, which does not have particular judicial oversight, reneging on contracts, changing the terms of agreement, particularly in extractive industries. And then, of course, we cannot forget the increasingly precarious humanitarian situation, which has the potential to increase violence along ethno-religious lines, which therefore would create dangers to humanitarian operations in Mali.
Well, Megan, I think I could talk to you all day about this, but we must wrap it up there. Your desk has been prudent in getting lots of reports out on this particular piece, just reading the update brief you did prior to the referendum now, and I'm sure you'll keep an eye on it. What an absolutely fascinating picture you paint, though, and I will look forward to seeing further further reports and further information on this. But for now, Megan, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for another episode of Civiline Insights. Big thank you to Leo Collins, Intelligence Delivery Lead at Civiline, for being my co-host today. And of course, a huge thank you to Megan Sutcliffe from our Middle East and Africa desk, taking us through the picture in Mali. Please do remember to like and subscribe, however you're getting this podcast. And as I've said, if you would like to get in touch with us to discuss anything we've talked about today or anything else, please do get in touch with us via our email address that will be included in the show notes. And of course, a big thanks to you for joining us. We look forward to welcoming you to the next episode.